This is Matt Wells at UN News. The people of Gaza can't understand the silence of the international community over the suffering that they're enduring. That's according to the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for the Occupied Palestinian Territory. Jamie McGoldrick's been telling UN News about the hardships that Palestinians face living in the Gaza Strip, where communities have endured an Israeli blockade for over 10 years. Hostilities between Israel and the enclave, which is controlled by the Palestinian militant faction Hamas, have increased in recent weeks, with deaths reported on both sides. But on Tuesday, the United Nations coordinator for the region told the Security Council that tensions had eased since the weekend, when war seemed to be just minutes away. Daniel Dickinson asked Mr. McGoldrick, who visited the Gaza Strip last week, what he'd seen.
Well, the thing I went down to do was to look at this increased restrictions that had taken place. As you know, the main crossing point that we use as humanitarians and as commercial is Kerem Shalom. And because of these incendiary devices being flown out into Israeli territory, there was further restrictions on the use of that port, so that area for us to transfer goods over. That's the first impact. And because of that, they then increase further restrictions, which then prevented our stuff coming in, humanitarian as well as fuel. And fuel is a big issue. Right now in Gaza, we as the UN emergency fuel supply over 220 institutions. That's water and sanitation, that's sewage plants, solid waste management. More importantly, about 60% of that fuel goes to hospitals and clinics.
So how is that lack of fuel affecting daily life?
I would say that some hospitals will close operations this week if they don't get this fuel in. Thankfully, this afternoon, there was an opening of the Kerem Shalom to let in some fuel. We haven't quite understood how much of that is against what we need. We've estimated we have enough fuel in the pipeline till mid-August, around 10th August. But what it means is that because of the increased pressure on the hospitals and the clinics, because of the demonstrations and the violence and the injuries, these hospitals are working around the clock because the treatment levels and the numbers that we deal with are so massive that we can't cut the fuel. So rather than having generators being backup, they're the main source of fuel. So you need maintenance, you need spare parts, which are difficult to get in as well.
You spend a lot of time in Gaza. Could you give us an idea of the state of mind of people who are living there? They must be incredibly resilient.
Well, they are, and they've traditionally been very resilient. They've had 11 years of a blockade, restrictions of movement. Some people of that age have never left Gaza. Some people have never gone out of that strip. It's only 42 kilometres long. So it's a very restricted area. The shipping and the fishing zone has been cut back now to 3 miles. You know, normally under the Oslo peace process, it was 20 miles and never quite got there. 12 is the most it's ever done. So people have a sense everything is constraining the way they want to try and live there. Agriculture produce doesn't go as easy as it could. Imports are very, very difficult, and difficult for two ways. One, the restrictions coming in, but I think more importantly is that the lack of purchasing power. I mean, 4 or 5 months ago, 10,000 trucks were coming in a month through these crossing points. Now it's down to 6,000, and that's demand driven because people don't have the money. The 60% of the population of 18 to 30 don't have work, they don't have a job. And then you've got UNRWA closing now and all the jobs and the services that go with that. So people have this, the inability to bear this any further. And that's why these demonstrations and the violence that comes with that and the number of people who have been killed and injured hasn't stopped the demonstrations. And it's a frustration. It's individuals who can take this no longer. And they want to try and tell the world and show the world that this is an unsufferable place.
Unusually for a person in your position, you actually spend the night in Gaza during your almost weekly visits there. What's the morale of people like? What are they telling you?
I think people really can't understand why they're being treated this way, why the international community is silent on many of the things that are going on. I think also the fact that UNRWA's funding has stopped.
And that's the UN agency.
The UN agency, the Relief Works agency, who supplies support to 1 million refugees, health, education. The schools probably won't open as expected at the end of August. So all of that adds undue pressure to an already very desperate situation. I mean, I think the health sector sort of tells the story of all that's wrong with Gaza. It's been undermined, underwhelmed, under-resourced for over 10 years. The Palestinian Authority don't pay the salaries anymore. Palestinian Authority in Ramallah doesn't pay for the budget support fully for that. So the resources required, the equipment required to keep the services going for the Palestinian population in Gaza is very, very desperate. And then this whole upsurge of injured people who come as a result of this march of return to the fence. We've had 9,000 people injured. In one day, we had almost 300 people shot and wounded on the 14th of May. And if you were to look at any hospital in any major capital in the world, be it London or Tokyo, they wouldn't be able to cope with that number. And yet these guys who are under-resourced and they don't have the support that they need and all the equipment they require and the expertise had to deal with that. And now we have this very tragic situation where you've got some 1,500 people who have been shot, mostly lower limb injuries from live ammunition at the fence from Israel, who will need five or six elective surgeries even before they start to go for rehabilitation. And there is no rehabilitation because there's no capacity there. There's no ability to treat those wounds properly. Many people were released into the community early because they didn't have the ability to treat them in the hospital. So you're going to have these bone diseases are going to kick in, amputation will take place, and many people of the next generation are going to be unable to perform and, you know, actually contribute to the society.
You're describing a very desperate situation, but this is a situation that the people of Gaza have faced before. What's different now?
Well, I think they faced it before. 2014 was the last time they had a war of sorts in Gaza. But I think this time the difference is that there's a lot more other pressures coming in as well. The fact that the economy shattered, the fact that the salaries are not being paid, the fact that UNRWA's disappearing because there's no funding for the main support UN operation in Gaza. I think that plus the whole violence, which has escalated, I think the difference is this time it's not part of a conflict, but the impact's the same. And I think people there believe that they are suffering unduly and the world is not listening to them. And I think that's the difference before. But there's been a change in the world order, as we all know. And I think Gaza and Palestine are no longer up there high on the list of what international community would be concerned about. And I think that tells a tale from us as well, because we're only 23% funded of our response plan for this year. And that's an indication, I think, the way that the world's maybe turning off to the crisis. One of the reasons I'm doing all the work I'm doing, advocacy otherwise, is to try and raise the profile, try and raise the issues, and at the same time trying to raise funding. I mean, it is a political crisis. It needs a political solution. And obviously that's what's been done by the special coordinator, Nikolai Mladenov. But that we can't wait for that to happen because the humanitarian situation is deteriorating dramatically. I mean, I can tell you two stories that would maybe sum up the whole thing. I went to the hospital in Shiva Hospital in Gaza last week. I met two young boys there. One was called Noor, 16-year-old, and one was called Hamza, 18-year-old. Both were shot weeks previous at the fence, both through the neck, C3 injuries, so spinal cord. Both of them are quadriplegic. So when I visited them in the hospital, Hamza was there, sitting there, and at the time the electricity went off, the 4 hours of electricity from the grid that goes on came off, and they had to switch to the generator. And so while they switched to the generator, he can't breathe independently, he has to use respirators. They collapsed. So they actually had to hand pump him to keep him alive till the generator came on. And then they had to then pump the fluid out of his throat and out of his lungs because he was choking. And then the other one, Noor, 16 years of age, he was watching the World Cup at that time. He had his iPad and he had his messy T-shirts and he had the Barcelona flags. And he really doesn't know the extent of his injuries. But neither of those two boys will ever walk again. There's no rehabilitation process. There's no that type of care available in Gaza. And yet they'll be a burden on their family who can't afford to have that. And it's going to be a significant, I think, impact for the hundreds of thousands of people who have been injured during this last couple of months.
You've called on the Israeli authorities to end restrictions on imports and exports. Yeah. Do they listen to these requests that put to them?
There are different levels in the government of Israel. I mean, we speak to them all and from a humanitarian point of view, and they understand the humanitarian condition. And I think they try to, you know, as best they can. But there are political forces that don't allow them maybe to be maybe as easy or as permissive as they could be. And I think that's the problem we face, because often it's their security agenda that takes the lead on the decision making. And whereas the humanitarian consequences of that are not quite fully appreciated. And, you know, clearly Israel has its significant and I think legitimate security concerns about where Gaza is situated in the southern part and the neighbouring towns and villages of Israel. But I think the impact on those restrictive measures are further exacerbating an already catastrophic situation.
But it sounds as though you do understand that the restrictions need to be put in place at some level.
Well, I mean, there has to be restrictions because there's a security agenda. But I think for me is that there also has to be, that has to be balanced against the need for us to address the humanitarian and the other economic livelihood concerns of people in Gaza. You can't keep that amount of 2 million people locked into an area without the ability to leave and without the ability to have fishing, to import and export, to do business, with all of those restrictions. And at the same time, unemployment's not there. The health services that you look around you, the education is not there, the social welfare, that the mental health services, which are much needed, are getting closed down because UNRWA doesn't get funded, as an example of the services that are needed in that very difficult context. I mean, suicide among young children and young people is very significant, and it's growing all the time. And that's because people see no end to this. And there's this very desperate dimension that's in people's lives, and it's all pervasive, and no one can escape what's there.
When aid does get through to Gaza, you have to deal with Hamas, which is a militant group. They control the Gaza Strip. What's it like working with Hamas?
We don't deal with Hamas. It's a political, there's a no-contact policy, but we have people who use as interlocutors. I mean, to be honest, as in any conflict, there are always those belligerents and always those groups who are out for their own ends, and they'll try and instrumentalise anything that we try and bring in. They try, obviously, to, as they do anywhere, to try and influence where aid goes and who gets aid. And we just have to stick to our principles and stick to the way we've always worked. There's a very tried and tested system in place that was there long before Hamas came on the scenes. And that system of the UNRWA and other colleagues who are working there, that's maintained. So we work through theirs. We don't get many complaints about aid diversion because there's not that much aid comes in. We don't have enough to cover what's already there. And I do think we've got enough good people and good systems and good abilities to check and balance against anything that happens there. I would say that given those conditions, the extraordinary work of the humanitarian community there, I mean, national NGOs, international NGOs, the UN agencies, including UNRWA, given all of those issues and the demand and the size and scale and magnitude, I mean, there's a very positive vibe and I think a very successful ability for us to address what we can within our very, I think, not enough funds, not enough capacity, not enough resources. But what we can do, we can do.
We heard on Tuesday in the Security Council that there's been a pulling back from the brink in terms of hostilities between Israel and Gaza. What could happen in the rest of the region? What will be the knock-on effects if those hostilities resume?
Well, I think everybody's very conscious of the fact, and I think, as is mentioned in the Security Council, there are many member states who are very concerned about the spillover into other areas. From the reports that were, the briefings that were given, there was mention of Lebanon, mention of Syria, mention of Iran. All of that is interconnected. I think that any instability in one, because of the interconnected nature of how Gaza and Palestine is, politically and otherwise, it will have a knock-on effect. So I think that the worry would be that you try and, where you can, you know, close down and prevent. And I think that's what has to be done. It's the prevention dimension we're looking at in this context. And so that you don't have flare up across lines, across fences and across borders, which has been the case over the last weeks. I think Gaza is very, very important because it's probably the focus, and it's probably the most intense focus of all the areas that are there. Maybe not the most political, but I think in terms of the humanitarian dimension, it's the one where the worst crisis is in this region.
As a humanitarian, you have to separate the humanitarian response from the political response. That must be very difficult. But if you could now give a list of what needs to be done on the humanitarian side to improve the lives of Palestinian people, what would you say?
Well, I think obviously the restrictions in Gaza have to be lifted. The ability for people to fish beyond the very tight limits they have, for businesses to be allowed to get permits and come in, for water to be much more increased coming in from Israel, from electricity power lines to be expanded, increased coming in from Egypt and Israel, for fuel to be allowed in to run the Gaza power plant, for electricity to be expanded so people can have a normal life, more than 4 hours a day. And then we can actually see how that would then treat the sewage, treat the ability to supply good water, and ultimately keep the hospitals and clinics going. And I think that's so important, because, and then getting the spare parts and getting the equipment in, which are restricted because they're seen as dual use list by the Israelis. An example of that would be that if you go to the Shiva Hospital basement, you've got a kidney dialysis program. Every single machine is working fully 24/7. People come in at 3 o'clock in the morning because they don't have enough machines, because they're lying in the corner broken without spare parts. And the demand is so great. And that's not just for that type of treatment, but it's for all sorts of treatment. So all of these things have to change, and people have to get the chance to work. And so we have to create a cash for work program, maybe 50,000 people for 6-9 months, to bring cash into the economy and give them some purchasing power, because people are living on nothing.